Okay, here for the slightly delayed weekend pod with Daniel. I had a barbecue to go to and you had a dinner. We didn't feast on the football, though. That was not awesome. Anyway, how was your dinner? Did you have fun?
The dinner was actually excellent. My sister-in-law nailed it. My sister-in-law makes the best jollof rice in London. I feel totally comfortable to say. So, yeah, the best jollof rice in London and some very good chicken, meat and hot sauce. I've just been to the sauna, obviously, because I love the sauna, of course. A fitness freak. My body is a temple. And then arrive and just hot food sort of makes me sweat anyway, which I guess is one of the reasons I like it. This like constant searching for things that feel different to the things that you're feeling normally, which I think might be an ADHD thing, but definitely something I have. But I just hadn't long since been in the sauna, showered when I hadn't cooled down from the sauna, and then just became extremely hot and like to the point where like the neck of my t-shirt was like a little bit wet.
Hey, hot spot. Well, as listeners will know, I spent a lot of my childhood in Birmingham, and so I spent a lot of time getting the hottest possible curry I could possibly get. So I think I've now deadened some of my senses to heat. So I've yet to be defeated by a chili.
I've killed my palate 100% with whiskey and hot food, I would say. Not that I ever had a particularly good sensitive palate in the first place. But I'm not your person. I'm not a delicate flavors guy. If you give me something with delicate flavors, I'll tell you it's bland. Yeah. And that is partly because my story of the squirrel.
Yes.
From the last pod. So I don't even know if this is interesting, but I happen to be in the middle of this aggravation. So I told Dan Reilly, he's a film director, listener also, and he said you should round this off on the pod. So here goes. I was returning my lease car and I realized that you have to fix everything, because if they come around and it's not fixed, they'll charge you and they'll have you over a barrel. Yeah. So they cleanse you. So I get all this stuff fixed. I get the alloys fixed. I get the alloys refurbished. I get all the dents that are big enough knocked out. And it costs me money and time. Then there's this engine light that keeps coming on. So I take it to my guys and I say, this engine light needs to not exist. And as a consequence of having the car for longer, a little bit longer to get all this nonsense done, I have to pay for a further MOT on top of everything else I'm paying for. So I've got all this going on in the background. Borrow a car for mates. Like, it's an old car and I forget to turn the lights off. And it's one of those old cars on which you have to turn the lights off. So I come back to it, won't start. Get some jump leads off a mate. I get it going. I eventually get it to the garage because it won't go immediately. And they say, well, they check it over for me. Everything's fine. So I say, well, if it starts, I guess I drive it home, get the car to start. But then I stop at some lights and it won't start. So I have to take it down, get doing a school run at this point. So I have to get someone else to do a school run. They have to drive the car back to the garage, leave it there overnight. They have a look at it, say it's fine. I turn up in the morning, like, well, if it starts now after idling all evening, then it's definitely fine. Drive it home. I go to pick my daughter up from school later that day. Nah, man. The car won't start. So I then have to tell the friend who's lent me his car that I can't return him his car because I fucked it up, because the battery is dead and it won't start and I must have killed the battery. But my breakdown is only on my car and I can't call the breakdown. So he then calls the breakdown and turns out it's a loose connection. The car gets going again. So it's cost me like a couple of taxes for him, but it's not the end of the world given how much money I've already been relieved of. I then get the Turkish guys, my Turkish brothers, get my car, get rid of the engine light. The guy comes to pick it up. He turns the car on and on comes the engine light. And so I now have this car. He won't take it away. He's not allowed to take it away. I passed his MOT. Yes. Passed his MOT yesterday. I call out the breakdown. They fix the engine light. I just think, well, I'll go and check on it. And also I've got a bit of gas in it that I want to use, because you only need to leave them with enough to get to the petrol station. And the engine light's come back on. I will update this staggeringly beautiful narrative, perhaps, at some
point. Multi-stage story, but, this is. Yeah, yeah.
This is like June.
I have an old Italian car, so check engine light is a daily routine. And most of the time I plug in a OBD2 scanner and work out what it is. If it's a minor thing that I can just go fix at some point myself. I just wipe the engine. I wipe the check engine lights because, you know, it's just a computer. So you just fix it. Fix the error signal.
This is literally the height of not being Jewish. The ability to even know what these things are that you talk about. I've never heard of them and I don't know what they are. And then the ability and the desire to actually resolve them. That this is something that is beyond Anglo-Jews. Like we have some kind of Holocaust trauma and aversion to DIY.
Yeah.
That's what we do. That's what we have.
Well, I have a very finicky old Maserati. It's as the reputation goes, they just break. It is actually not broken, but there's many little things I've had to do to fix or improve it. So I've been learning to do mechanical stuff on the job, really, because I didn't really know what I was doing.
Fixing and improving things sounds like a good skill set. Could you manage meningitis?
I somehow doubt it because I don't know whether you should learn that on the job. But given that our last three CEOs have learned that on the job, maybe it's all right. I don't know. Yeah, nice.
Pick that segue
exactly.
Out.
Right in the top bins with that one. Mind you, when you started on the car story, I thought it was going to be squirrel story. And we went from food to squirrel. I thought this was going to have a very, very unpleasant ending. I'm glad you're not into eating squirrels, Dan.
What they call in America, I love the fact that they call people that do this shit outdoorsmen. Not enjoys killing animals, but that he's a big outdoorsman. You find them talking about like Brock Lesnar. I remember when he was in the UFC, they called him a big outdoorsman. You mean he's not satisfied with bullying people. He also enjoys bullying defenseless animals.
Yeah. When a restaurant I really liked in San Francisco, I don't know if it's there anymore, it was this Peruvian restaurant. And obviously it did the, what do they eat? It's like a big guinea pig. I forget.
I can't remember
what they call it. They kind of spatchcock it.
That's what they call it. That's what they call it in Ghana, grass cut.
It's basically a guinea pig they've spatchcocked. And it looks like a big squirrel, basically, flattened out and grilled. And it's really, really tasty. But now I'm thinking about your squirrel murdering and whether you're setting up a restaurant to do it. All right, on to the football. We could talk about squirrel murdering all night because it's more entertaining than that game. How did we go from the excitement and the drama and the passion and the desire to win of Liverpool to that fucking hot mess against Brentford, in which we should have lost that one 4-0 again, really, and I don't think we could have complained.
It was in the post-Fergie wilderness years, it was up there or down there with the real fucking worst. And part of it is, as you say, the game before. And I felt at the time we were unlucky, I guess, that it was international week.
Lost momentum.
Or international fucking decade, it sounded like, because we couldn't keep the momentum, as you say, that we had going into that game. But it's a funny one because this sounds like a weird thing to say, given that I quite like Manchester United and spent quite a lot of my life involved in them in one way or other. But I barely gave a fuck when that goal went in. And I tell, because it feels like at this point, we don't need the points. I didn't not go, oh shit, we're never going to get top four or top five now, because I didn't think that before. And the only thing that matters at this point is performance, because if there are performances, the manager might stay. And if there aren't, he won't. And it felt to me like that was really the dividing line. What they're left now, is it 7 games, 8 games and 2 in the cup?
8, I think.
I don't know if he's got enough road left. Even if it suddenly gets brilliant next week, which seems unlikely, it doesn't feel like there's enough. It's not acceptable to say, well, we'll buy you a midfield player, another centre back, a right back, and then leave you to stick with this, because it's fucking bullshit.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I had one of those strange reactions to the goal, which was a sort of half jump, half laugh, because I was like, how the hell are we going to win this game? But of course, like, I should not have had that. How the hell are we going to get away with highway robbery? I should have thought, oh no, of course they're going to screw it up. Because do you know how many times United had conceded a goal, like within 10 minutes of scoring this season? It's 13. 13 times.
Thank you at Ron Lennon for this one.
Yeah.
And did you know how many times they've conceded a goal after scoring themselves? Oh, sorry, did you just do after scoring or after
conceding?
I think
after scoring, but it's also the same for conceding, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
It's the same as conceding. Both 13 goals. I mean, that is mind-boggling incompetence and weakness.
Yeah. And I can't pin that all on the manager, although I have to say his post-match interviews, so press conference and interviews, are one of the worst I've ever seen from a United manager. So clearly it's incompetence on the field, incompetence. They can't manage their game. Clearly there's a lot of that. And so pinning a lot of the blame on the players is perfectly justifiable there. But afterwards, Ten Hag, at first he threw them all under the bus by saying they didn't have enough passion and desire. That was his...
Brentford wanted it more. But when you say that, you're also criticising yourself because obviously they have professional responsibility, but also...
You're the manager.
Like, imagine anyone saying that. Imagine Jurgen Klopp ever saying that. And the reason he's not saying it is partly he has because of the players, but also he's making sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. You never, and Liverpool were dreadful last season. I think it'd be hard to pin lack of desire on them at any point because, of course, it comes from Klopp and his sort of personality. So there's something about that. And Ten Hag, the technocrat, as we have quite long suspected, doesn't have the kind of riz to turn that particular piece around and get people following him, running through brick walls, as the cliche goes. So there's that. But also, then he said afterwards, well, they didn't have great chances. And this was about Brentford. 2.6 XG, by the way. So they had enough.
How many times did they hit the ball?
Three, I think it was. 31 shots and 85 touches in our box, in the United box. That is that.
The 85 touches is the most any team has managed in the Premier League in the last 5 years.
It's just incredible.
Yeah. And this is Threadman Chazza, so thank you, Threadman Chazza, for this one. Only two teams in the top 5 European leagues conceding more shots per game than United this season, and those are Sheffield United and Luton, and the gap's not massive. They've got 17.93 and 17.20 average, and United 17. And only two teams in the top 5 European leagues have conceded more XG. Ten teams have conceded more XG than United.
So I have 100 teams. Yeah.
This thing about low-quality chances is bollocks. It's not true. And the point is if let's say that it's a feature, not like he's doing it on purpose to some extent.
Yeah.
Why don't you try and stop doing it? It's not good.
Yeah.
In fact, maybe it's even bad.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, look, we saw City and Arsenal yesterday play out. Like, I've seen paint drying that's more exciting and dynamic than that. But One of the things they both do is manage the shots against Arsenal particularly are probably the best in Europe at managing the amount of shots they concede. You don't concede shots, you don't concede goals. It's not like super difficult arithmetic, this one. And United do. But the even worse, the even more damning thing than conceding 31 shots and those 85 touches in the box is the fact that it was only half the plan. If you say that's the plan, we're going to soak up pressure, we're going to defend the box, do box defending, and then hit them on the transition. You've got to actually fucking hit them on the transition. It didn't do any of that either.
Because, I mean, you see this, right? And it reminded me a bit when you're playing kind of Sunday League and you're on the ball and you look around and you think, is there anyone else here? There are always like a couple of lads that you don't really want to pass to. And Wan-Bissaka and McTee are those lads. Yeah. You don't want to pass them the ball. And this is playing for Manchester United. I mean, it's fucking ridiculous, really. And I tell you what was incredible, though, was you bring back Martinez and Varane gets injured.
Which is brilliant.
And you bring back Maguire and Lindelof gets injured. I mean, that doesn't exactly matter. But that Martinez-Varane is just so classic post-Fergie Wilderness years gear that. Yeah, no, you will not have your only two decent defenders playing together. And that's why I find myself... the only things that make me think maybe we should stick with Ten Hag. That, and I don't know who the other option is. And I don't think not knowing who the other option is a good reason to keep anyone. But the fact that he has had so much other shit going on, but then you see the way United press.
Oh, it's how easy totally it is. Totally discoordinated,
it is so... so easy for them to get out. Like that chip over the lift over the, to yeah. the fullback. It's just so easy. And then at the back, another goal from yeah. a cutback.
Yeah, yeah.
I tell Again, you what, features, though, not Ivan bugs. Toney was. Yes. Ivan Toney.
Yeah, yeah, he really was. Yeah.
I think he might be a better player. I mean, I thought he was a good player. I think he might be a better player than I thought he was.
He was very good for England as well. Real number nine, and obviously created the Brentford's goal. Well, three players were attracted to him, and then three players sort of stood around Aya, not doing anything about the game.
Yeah, it was a great defense. That is true. But and to go back to what you said about the interview, for the first time, probably, I thought, he's sort of given up on himself.
It felt like it. That felt very late stage, that did. And like, you know, he got all defensive about the tactical stuff. So he chucked him under the bus with a passion and desire, which is, okay, fine, if you're going to do that to elicit a response, yeah. But then hit...
Or just because you're
Just because you're angry and pissed off, yeah, fine. But then he got all defensive about the tactics when people were pointing out that they conceded so many chances. And I think you got to own it all round, really. And he didn't. And that's why it was one of the worst, like, wilderness years press conferences. There's been plenty of bad ones. But but at least the others had, like, the others all had charisma. Like, Van Gaal talking about getting his bollocks out and Mourinho being Mourinho. And like, even Moyes to some extent, even if he was rabbit in the headlights, at least he kind of knew himself. He didn't know that he wasn't good enough for the United job, but... He's comfortable enough in his own skin. Ten Hag, I really worry about this part. And like, I was very much like, well, maybe there's good coaching there. He's just kind of, he's managing this period of insane amount of injuries and workload from last season. And he's having to put square pegs and round holes constantly as a result. But he gave up on plan A, which was to build a team in the whatever style he was trying to build it in. And plan B has this awful mess of defending badly and creating hardly any chances. I just don't know what that is. And we've asked ourselves right throughout this season, what is the end point here? We're no closer to finding out.
And yet you look at his back four and you're like, how can it be good?
Well, yeah.
With this,
yeah.
I do keep coming back to that. How could it? Like, you get a guy in who is a systems guy. You don't give him the players that he asks for. You let him pick dickheads in some aspects. Then you again don't necessarily give him the players that he asks for. You then get a shitload of injuries at the same time you've got the Greenwood situation, the Anthony situation, and the takeover situation. How can it be good? And this is, I genuinely think this is a fair question. And yet, shouldn't be like this.
No, it shouldn't. And I think the thing is, like, although social media kind of lends itself to kind of binary statements, it's definitely not binary here. Like, it's not all on him, but it's enough on him to make you start asking serious questions about whether giving him another few hundred million to go fix all the problems in the squad is a gamble too far, right? Is that more likely to succeed than getting another guy in to go spend that few hundred million on fixing the squad and getting rid of all the dickheads? It's really hard.
Well, literally no idea, because who is the other guy? And so let's say Ruben Amorim goes to Liverpool. No idea if he's good. Do think he's probably got a bit of the cheesy rabble-rousing that they want, that maybe we could use as well. But let's say Ruben Amorim goes there, so it's not him. Then who are you actually left with who they might get? Simone Inzaghi doesn't feel like he's someone they're going to get. Thiago Motta, someone I'd be interested in. That, and then otherwise, you're left with, like, what? Potter and Southgate. If it's one of those two, then I guess I'm thinking much, much more carefully about keeping it enough.
Yeah. Potter and Southgate do not inspire me. Although they seem to be going on a kind of Brexit binge at the moment. They're going to hire Ashworth and Jason Wilcox. And there have been enough reports saying they're looking at, like, building some Britishness into it all.
Well, Sid, big uncle Sir Jim is Brexit. Yep. Brexit Tory. So keep United English. I don't know.
I don't know how seriously to take any of that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, certainly talk of Potter and Southgate has me like running into the arms of Ten Hag's warm embrace, you know.
Well, all I would say on Southgate, I said this on Twitter, there is definitely people at another Premier League club that think United are going for Southgate. That's a fact. Don't know if it's true. It just seems almost like, even if he was good, when's he available? Middle of July or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Is he so good that you're waiting for him, so you're jeopardising your pre-season plans and all the rest of it? Because, yeah, I mean, he's going to be busy. So,
yeah, it doesn't seem to stack up. Yeah.
While we're talking about Southgate, it's not exactly gossip, but it feels like he's now perceived as the guy in the wrong in the Ben White situation, where Ben White didn't like football and Southgate was unable to cope with this. So Steve Holland had a fight with him. That's what I was told at the time, was that Ben White was acting like an arsehole. And the senior players took him aside and said, listen, mate, like, we think we can win this. You could be part of something really special. Mm-hmm. Maybe stop being a dick and objectionable and you'll be a part of it. And next morning he's rolling around on the floor with Steve Holland. So the way it was told to me was it came via a player, not directly from a player, but via a player. Yeah. Ben White acted up rather than Southgate. But then,
yeah. I mean, look, he's a good politician, Southgate. I'll give him that. He seems to manage the chaos around England in a kind of very calm and professional manner. The players seem to like him for whatever reason. I hate the football that, like, with an incredibly talented group of English players in most positions, not all of them.
I guess. You could maybe excuse he doesn't have enough time to get it going, but we've seen international teams play nice football before.
Yeah.
And I wonder now if maybe it's the idea of football being more complex than it used to be that makes you be more conservative. But also, he was a defender and he played for shit teams and he managed shit teams. So you're if you're starting the season as a manager trying to stay up or whatever, then generally, and the way football was at the time, you're going to be defensively minded.
I just wonder how up to date he is as well on like modern coaching, because he spends 2 to 3 days with England players before a game and then maybe another 2 to 3 days before the next game. So he doesn't actually do very much coaching at all. And he last managed a team at Middlesbrough in 2006 and then onto the under-21s and he was part of the FA setup. Anyway, it doesn't make any sense to me, but...
And also, Steve Holland is not someone I would have said or thought was at the cutting edge.
No, it doesn't sound great. But as you say, there's very little time. I do go back to first principles, which is like they said, Ratcliffe has said that they will pick a club style. It's clear that they're putting their management team into place. Berada starts in June. Ashworth will start around them. I bet it's the start date run the money that is the real issue there. I'm sure Newcastle would like to punt it to the end of whatever window it is, given that they probably see us as rivals. And then Wilcox is coming in, it seems, like if reports today are true, for this technical director's position. So they're getting the team in place.
He's resigned, right? Apparently. Fabrizio Romano said he's resigned. I read a tweet earlier that said Southampton are angered, which made me laugh because it was language used by Spirit of Shankly once about something. Spirit of Shankly are angered. Okay.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking about this with Southampton. What have they got? What exactly is he's doing for them on a day-to-day basis now? I mean, they've got a few games left in the championship season. And then, yeah, so what? So what if they're angered?
I don't think, their goalkeeper's going, do you know what? I can't be asked to this anymore. Because that guy that used to play on the opposite wing to Stuart Ripley has decided he wants to go Man United.
I know. It's all very odd, isn't it? Yeah. Fabrizio, while we're talking about him, I mean, like, I don't blame him at all for having a sideline business, doing social media posts for footballers and or clubs and being paid for it. That's totally fine if he wants to do that. Problem is, like, is he a journalist or is he a social media or is he a person, or is he a personality? He seems to be blending the three, which creates a fair level of cynicism, I think, about his work. But there you go. That is a complete adjunct to what we were actually talking about. Which was the absolute crap on the pitch. Where do United go from here for the next game? I mean, we've got Chelsea on Thursday, and like, we can't have that level of performance again. And then we got Liverpool in the Premier League on Sunday. I think I'm right in saying that. We've talked so much about bouncing back from 16 defeats. So I suppose it wasn't the 17th. Certainly felt like it, though. I just don't know how you go about picking a side now for this one and going, well, where do I level the blame for that style of performance?
Yeah, where are your consequences? Yeah.
Well, that's what we talked about that previously, didn't we? How much there was a lack of consequences for failure at United. Like, who does he blame for this? What does he swap around?
Well, you get to that point where does Rashford's performance deserve dropping, or are you thinking, if we're going to get anything out of this season, we need him in the team?
I bend to the latter. I mean, it wasn't good, but at least he was running at players in the three touches he had.
It's difficult because you don't know what his instructions are, but you can't help but think that they weren't put in that quantity of effort. And I would take the offer. If we get one, I'll take it. Because can't keep having these conversations. And the thing again, it's like not dissimilar to what I was saying with Ten Hag, where it's just so easy to excuse him, where it's just like, okay, but you've scored 131 United goals.
Yeah.
So it is. A lot of them in big games against good teams, such that if we were about to get good, you've earned the right, despite everything, to be a part of that, or at least to get the opportunity to be a part of that if we are going to get good.
It's a big if, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, he wasn't good. Yeah. Garnacho kept running. Hoyland hardly ever in the game. Not his fault, didn't get the ball to him very much. Maynou wasn't bad, but he wasn't brilliant. He didn't completely bypass him. He did have like twice the number of passes of Scott McTominay, who never makes a pass because that's not his job.
Twice times zero, still zero.
True. I mean, the back four was obviously under a hell of a lot of pressure the whole game. That it was a horrendous goal to concede, but there aren't many options there. Presumably, Martinez will play. Ryan came off as a precautionary, but it doesn't mean he'll be fit for Thursday at all. So it might be that we have, Maguire and Martinez as centre-backs. The full-backs, we haven't got any other choices. They will be the full-backs again, for better or worse. Yeah. Casemiro, I guess he's fit. He came on, gave the ball away like five times, and then got himself booked for a horribly wild tackle again. It's like the rigueur with him, isn't it?
Yes.
All right, coming back to the Brentford game briefly, I thought it might be worthwhile mentioning a couple of players who had a good day. One is Mason Mount, who scored. I mean, didn't play for very long, but a good moment for him after wasting most of this season injured. And Andre Onana, who made quite a lot of good saves and generally has tidied up his game a lot in recent weeks. So coming to the latter, Onana, has he done enough to change your mind? You were very much Onana out earlier this season.
Maybe. I mean, I think we said that the level of error he was making is not possible these would persist, because if these were a feature, he'd never have got anywhere near Inter or Ajax, even, or his school team, never mind United. I don't like the untidiness. I'd like to see more of the passing. No, he's going to be here next season, I would imagine. I'd be surprised if they got rid of him. So, and he's been, I'd say good is strong, because he hasn't had that much. It's not saying he's not been good. It's just he's done the things that are expected of him. I'm not sure he's made too many saves where you're thinking, that was a save that I wouldn't expect almost any goalkeeper standing in United's net to make. But yeah, he's been better. I thought Dallo was maybe one of the better ones also. And as you say, it was an excellent goal from Mount. And the question still persists. What do we do with him?
I have no idea. It definitely didn't answer that question.
Move Garnacho back to the right. Move Garnacho back to the right. Drop Rashford. Like, it feels like he didn't do that when he had the chance. Rashford was being dreadful. So and he didn't have wingers, but, and I guess he won't want to rush Mount back. So even if someone was injured, I think he'd still want to probably leave Mount on the bench, given how long he's been out and how many injuries he's had. But he's a good player, Mason Mount. I just don't see, I don't see the use for him. But then if you go and sign two midfield players in the summer, a Casemiro replacement, maybe one other, then you've actually got quite a good stable of midfield players. I mean, I'm sure something will go wrong because, like, ultimately, Fergie did some kind of Dorian Gray with this, where he said, yeah, United will be good for as long as I'm the manager and then shit forevermore thereafter, which feels like a good deal to me. But, I mean, something bad will happen.
Onana will definitely stay because there's other priorities, and I guess we're getting clearer on what the budget will look like. And it's not the top end of the range because they're not going to be in the Champions League, and it's a stretch to get into the Europa at this stage. So it may even be the Conference League, which is not awesome. United in the third division. Oh, that, mind you, once upon a time we won the Cup Winners' Cup and we were delighted with that, and that was generally considered the third tier European competition. So maybe we shouldn't malign the Conference League, which I think generally has actually been a success because it's opened up European football to different teams.
And still won by the richest teams. Still won by West Ham. And whoever it will be this year, who's still in there? Brighton's still in it.
No, they lost to Ajax, didn't they?
Yeah, Ajax. I know what you mean. In the same way, it's a success. It's, I guess, also in the way the Nations League was a success. And it took a turd and it added sweet corn or whatever. So it was a bit better looking than before, but still extremely suboptimal.
On the budget, I mean, clearly it will be reduced because like Champions League. I mean, they do have their contract with Adidas is different now, so they're not taking the penalty. Although they were in the Champions League this season, so it wouldn't have counted under the contract anyway, but they don't have this 2 years out of the Champions League discount thing. They also reduce the wages of the players, which balances the budget out a little bit, not entirely. So Champions League is still very important. The other thing to consider on the FFP perspective is that 21-22 will come out of cycle after June. Now, that was bundled with the previous year anyway because there were COVID. So it's quite unclear to me exactly how much of a hit United have on that season, given that everyone was allowed some COVID impairment. Not quite Everton levels. They tried to claim a ridiculous amount. So
my guess would be, and this predates Ratcliffe, my guess would be that United are quite happy for people to think they don't have money. And my guess would be there's a bit more money available in a bit more FFP headroom or whatever they're calling it now.
I think there's quite a bit. It's just not going to be as much as it could have been with Champions League football. And then we don't actually know that $200 million, whatever that works out to, that Ratcliffe was supposed to put in two chunks. One initially $100 million, the next $100 million by the end of this calendar year. We don't know exactly where that'll be spent. It was earmarked in theory for infrastructure projects, but since he's basically said they're going to knock down Old Trafford and build a new one, like, is it worth spending $200 million on like a bit of red paint on Old Trafford? So they may have different thoughts on that. If that go-no-go decision's already been effectively made on the new stadium, maybe there is more headroom to put in owner funding. We'll find out.
And also, the players, like, if we take a big bid for Rashford, then that plus what we have would presumably be more or less enough to buy the players that we think we need to buy at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Rashford has a huge impact on PSR because of the total lack of amortization and the fact that it'll go straight on the books as an academy player. I mean, it's Chelsea's model. They're going to sell Conor Gallagher this summer, aren't they? And it's entirely to make up depending on who you believe on the analysis, maybe £100 million shortfall on their FFP.
That'd be good players to be got out of Chelsea. I read the other day that they'd sell Reece James,
You'd have him. His injury record is absolutely horrendous, though, isn't it?
So he's meant the operation he's just had, I believe, is meant to have sorted out that hamstring situation. I would balk at signing Reece James because
so risky.
You just don't know. Are you gonna feel like a massive risk? But if you had a fit Reece James, I would sign him.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think he's the best, most balanced right back in the Premier League. I mean, he's great going forward and at the back, and he doesn't have the range of passing of Trent or something like that, but he's much better defensively. So, yeah, he would be an excellent choice just after this, season, the injuries. He's got just be mental to risk it, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And he's got the pace and the skill that Alexander-Arnold doesn't have. Like, Alexander-Arnold obviously has the vision, the range of passing, but Reece James, if you play him at right back and he's fit, he'll get you goals. And he can play wing back. If you third centre back, depending, like, gives you the opportunity to shuffle formation in matches. I said this on Twitter yesterday. The other player I'd be looking to get, but this is obviously the other end as well, Beck.
I saw your tweet there.
I've said this on here before. I think I've said it before, but the reason I would go well back is he's out of contract. He'll want to come to United. He's not unlikely to come to United and go rambling like Cavani did. And what I like about him is he's something different, and he's really good at bringing other people into play. He makes things happen. The finishing, and we know, isn't the best, but he can play a variety of positions, and he's someone who the other players can play off, and he's a different option. And that's what I'm looking at, because until we're good, no strikers coming, no proper strikers likely to come and play second fiddle to Højlund when they know you're playing 4-3-3 probably, and there's one striker and it's going to be him. And so it won't be, you're not going to go and sign someone who's 23 and brilliant, because we need so much other shit. And I'd still want someone else, but I think that if I'm trying to compile a stable of strikers where I've got my number one, then I'm looking for people that give something a bit different to what we have, but who can still play in the way that we want them to play. And I guess I see Welbeck almost that kind of Sheringham, who isn't obviously good enough to start, but if you did have to start him, it would be fine. And he just offers you that Sheringham thing, like nice touch, nice imagination, and aerial threat.
Yeah, I'm sure they are thinking about it in similar terms, which is older, experienced striker or young one. But we already have one young one, so it'd be an even younger one, which would be an interesting route to go. I mean, there's definitely no point getting someone mediocre. I mean, they definitely need another body in there, an actual number nine. Given that, I think we've seen enough of Marcus Rashford to say that it's not his best position. And yeah, just getting a mediocre 25-year-old, what's the point? So I don't know whether Welbeck's the answer there, but yeah, an experienced one or a young one, probably an experienced one would be the better bet. And that will be Dan Ashworth's job to identify that person along with the newly refreshed recruitment department and hopefully a refreshed medical department. We haven't heard anything about that yet. But after this season,
I mean, we've heard, it currently feels like we might have an over-refreshed medical department.
Yeah.
What I want to say is someone I know from back in the day, a massive red of not much older than me, passed away this weekend. His name was Mark Kirshner. And that guy used to always, one of my mates who I go to the game with, Mark, would always phone him on January the 11th and insist that they went out for a pint. And that is, I'm going to leave that one out there. What happens on January the 11th? You can send us some answers. But this is for me, yeah, like in order to say Chaim Arukim to his family, may they have a length of days and may his memory be for a blessing. So, yeah, I'm gonna just say that. And
This one's for Mark then, in that case. And sorry, it wasn't a better performance last weekend, but there are more important things in life than kicking a ball around the field, aren't there? Thank you very much for listening. We will be back after the Chelsea game.
Please.